It is one of the cruel realities of life. We all know loss, and we all know disappointment. Today's guest is a poet and author whose new book offers wisdom and even hope for anyone who has felt that pain. She's Maggie Smith, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my great friend G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, poets, authors, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by Maggie Smith, an award-winning poet whose new book is titled simply, Keep Moving. Maggie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been on the show before, and as we sat back and talked about sort of where we should be at the end of 2020, and after the year that we have had as a planet and as a country, we thought of you, somebody to help us make sense of this. So thank you so much for coming back. But you've got a new book that really sort of, I think, captures this moment of getting through loss and through trial and emerging on the other end maybe stronger. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah, so I was thinking every ending is also a beginning. And at the end of my marriage, I began writing a book without realizing I was writing a book. The Keep Moving began as a series of tweets, though that word seems strange. It began as a series of tweets, really little self pep talks that I would write first thing in the morning and post on Twitter and on Instagram as a way of kind of talking myself through a difficult time. I joke that it was sort of like trying on hope, like a garment that did not fit at first. It felt really uncomfortable and scratchy and oversized and misshapen. And the more I tried it on, the more I told myself it would be okay, the more I believed it. And it actually kind of worked.
So these were messages to yourself that you were just throwing off into the ether?
Yeah. They were messages to myself. I mean, Part of what happens, I think, when we're going through a tough time is our self-talk is really unkind. We tend to beat ourselves up. And so the idea really is that we deserve the compassion that we would extend to others. You know, to talk to yourself the way you would talk to your sister or brother-in-law or best friend or parent when they're going through something hard and they come to you, why don't we extend that kind of grace to ourselves? And so I was writing these little notes to self, you know, Twitter sized, and posting them really as a way to hold myself accountable for whatever that message was for the day. Because if I had just written it on a post-it, I could have forgotten about it. But by coming out as someone who was having a struggle, and holding myself accountable for whatever that action was and being vulnerable in front of thousands of people, a couple of unexpected things happened. One, it actually started to make me feel better doing it every day. And then two, I heard from people all over the world that, you know, something that I'd written just for me felt like it was written just for them. And having that sense of community in a place like Twitter, in a time that dark, actually made me feel less alone than I felt at the time.
So during that dark time, when you're writing these tweets and whatever, essentially notes to yourself, which became this book, were you writing poetry too, poems at all? Or was this really your writing outlet? Because obviously a poet is a writer first and foremost. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm never not writing poems. So I've continued to write poems even as I was working on the essays for this book, because it's a collection of the quotes, some new ones, some of the sort of most popular ones that I tweeted, and then it's got these essays that are woven through the book. So even as I was writing those essays, and even as I was writing the tweets every morning, I didn't really think of the tweets as my work, as my writing. It was more something I was doing for myself emotionally than I was doing for myself as a writer. And so, yeah, I'm always working on poems, thank goodness.
So, I think we're going to have you do a reading. What is your first reading? Because again, we love this book and we want to hear it through your voice.
So maybe I'll read a little section from one of the essays
That'd be great.
about optimism, which is something I'm relatively new to. But what good timing, because I need it now in this year more than ever.
We all need it more than ever in this pandemic year, don't we? Yeah,
Yes.
so true.
So this is an excerpt from the last essay in the book. Something unexpected and frankly life-altering happened when my marriage ended. I realized that I could no longer afford to be a pessimist. I could no longer allow my worst thoughts to gather twigs and ribbons and make a permanent home in my mind. I realized pessimism wasn't going to get me out of bed, or get the coffee made, or pack the kids' lunches, or do the laundry, or make my deadlines. Pessimism wasn't going to help me or my children. And so, in a very dark time, it occurred to me that being optimistic moment by moment was a gift I could give myself. Even if whatever I'm hoping for doesn't materialize, I am feeding my spirit in the meantime. I am not poisoning the present with worry or despair or defeatist thinking. Today, I think of myself as a recovering pessimist. I know that optimism is not at odds with wisdom, it's quite the opposite. I think of cynicism as cool but lazy, while hope is desperately uncool. It has sweaty palms and an earnest smile on its face. What I know to be true is that one hopeful person will accomplish more than 100 cynics. Why? Because the hopeful person will try.
Wow,
That's
powerful.
powerful stuff. Maggie, I sort of I smiled when I read that passage because I've only met you once before when you were on the show, but I was sort of stunned to find that you were a recovering pessimist. And I just wonder, is that has that always been part of who you are? And what does that realization mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of us, I was one of those people who expected the worst as a form of self-protection, right? So if we expect the worst, if we think we won't get the job, or the diagnosis is going to be dire, or the person we are interested in won't call us, or we didn't ace that test, we definitely blew it. What that does is create a space in which we've protected ourselves. We steeled ourselves against that worst case scenario happening. And so if it happens, we can think, oh, see, I knew it. I was right. And we've somehow prepared ourselves for that. And if something good happens, then we're just pleasantly surprised. And so I think I've always lived that way. But I got to a point in, particularly in 2018, when things were just really, really hard on a daily basis, when I realized I couldn't function as a person, as a writer, as a parent, if I allowed myself to live in that space constantly. So why, if it's sunny, why be thinking about the rainstorm that may happen tomorrow or next week or next year? Why not just let the sun be warm on your face in that moment, regardless of what might be coming down the pike? And I needed that. So it really was out of need that I sort of turned to optimism as a way to live my life on a daily basis.
But your one of your more famous poems is Good Bones, which is sort of a reflection on life and the challenges of life. And we talked about this extensively when you were on last time, but that's a fundamentally optimistic message too, that for all of the flaws in the house that we're buying or the lives that we're living, it's got good bones. There's optimism. You're not a new optimist in that respect.
No, although it's funny that you say that poem is optimistic. I believe it is also. But I've heard from lots of people that they think it's really depressing. And I think, you know, what I think it is, and I think we all writers have obsessions or themes that we return to over and over. And sometimes we don't know until very late in our careers, and our practices, what those themes are. And one thing I'm thinking about, you know, as Keep Moving comes out, as I look back to Good Bones and I think, okay, it's about not only finding light in darkness, but creating it. And not only feeling like I can create light and darkness, but the need, the actual idea that we must create light and darkness. I mean, that poem basically ends with a call to action, which is you could make this place beautiful.
Maggie, yeah. I want to go back to what you were saying earlier, the voice or the narrative that you told yourself, I'm assuming from childhood, that things are not going to work out, that things are going to be dark, they're going to be bad, it's going to be, you know, a bad ending. Some of those thoughts must still be in your head, but it seems like you've reached sort of a Zen-like atmosphere or place to be where you probably still sometimes hear those voices, but just kind of sit with them, put them aside, just realize it's in your head, but it isn't really what is happening. It's just thoughts. I mean, this is what I take from meditation. Talk about that, because I see a real correlation between meditation, certainly the kind I do through Headspace, and your poetry, and now your great book of essays and written tweets.
Wasn't that what they say all the time? Feelings aren't facts. Right. So just because you're feeling a certain way doesn't mean that that is an accurate representation of the situation. I think, you know, part of what I have to keep in mind is that as many things can go right as can go wrong. And so really opening myself up to possibility instead of trying to write the story before it's really happened is realizing I'm in the present. I don't know what the future will look like. The future meaning 10 minutes from now or 10 months from now. And so the best thing I can do is set myself up to be in a good place 10 months from now. And the best way I can do that is by enjoying myself now. I mean, I think really probably the best indicator for future peace of mind is current peace of mind. So the more I can do to make this moment livable, the more livable the next moment will be, and the next moment will be.
And that certainly is good guidance for all of us, whether into meditation or poetry or whatever, during the COVID period when so much is justifiably gloomy.
Yeah, and uncertain, and that's scary. I mean, we like to know.
You know, Maggie, 2020 for so many Americans has been such a dark year. One of the themes that I thought emerged from Keep Moving is the idea that it's okay to find happiness even amidst the darkness. In fact, maybe it's something we have to do. You've got a one of your quotes about that. Could you share that with us?
Oh, sure. So one of the quotes is this. Do not turn away joy, even if it arrives at an inconvenient time, even if you think you should be grieving, even if you think it's too soon. Joy is always on time. Keep moving.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 18 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Maggie Smith, an award-winning poet whose new book, Keep Moving, offers notes on loss, creativity, and change, with real insights for this moment in America. You can find Maggie on Twitter at Maggie Smith Poet. That's MaggieSmithPoet. So where does that sort of resiliency come from in you?
I mean, in a lot of ways, it comes from being a parent, I think. You know, they're looking to me to guide them through their lives, and their lives this year do not look like their lives did last year. And frankly, because of the divorce, their lives last year didn't look like their lives looked the year before. So we've been through a lot of change together. And so what I'm really trying to model for them is acknowledging when things are hard, not, you know, not being a Pollyanna, not sticking our heads in the sand, not acting like there isn't a problem when there is a problem, acknowledging the problems, because we can't deal with them unless we see them and name them, but also not letting that be the whole story, not letting that be the thing that sort of dictates how the whole day or the whole week or the whole month or the whole year will go, and trying to find pockets of relief, even joy, in this time, and not feeling guilty about it, as if because there is so much suffering and so much uncertainty that we don't deserve to also feel pleasure and take pleasure in things at this time. I think we need to, really more than ever. I am so grateful for laughter right now. I can't even tell you. I'm so grateful for just having a silly dance party with my kids, or going roller skating with another middle-aged woman in my neighborhood. it can't be all heavy all the time. It just can't. It can't be like that for us, and it can't be like that for our kids.
So I want to read one of my favorite sentences from Keep Moving. It's on page 18, and have you break it down for us. This is just so elegantly and beautifully written and contains so much truth. And so let me read it. Whether you're on the first draft of your life or the second or the 10th, it's yours to keep writing in all of its messiness, fragility, and terror and beauty. Break that down for us.
Well, it's, you know, when I was going through my divorce, it felt catastrophic to me, because I thought that the life I was living was the life, the one version, the definitive version, the final, you know, the PDF version that you're not even going to have to get in and edit again. And something I realized when my marriage ended was, oh, okay, I have to reframe this experience now. That was a chapter. It was a long chapter, but it was a chapter. And so my favorite part of writing is revision. It doesn't scare me on the page. It does not scare me at all to look at a poem or an essay and realize it is not the best words in the best order. It is, in fact, the wrong words in the wrong order. That is pleasure to me as a writer, the sort of creative problem solving of that. And so I have tried my best to look at my life in that same spirit, which is, I didn't want it to change, but it changed. And so now what do I do with it? And trying to see it as an opportunity. Yes, it's painful. I mean, it was not fun at all. It hurt like hell. But also trying to see it as an opportunity to grow and change and maybe do some things differently that I wouldn't have considered as possibilities because I thought that the thing was just written.
So the last word in that sentence is beauty, which brings me to maybe my favorite phrase in the whole book, which is beauty emergency. And, you know, I actually read that, and I read most of the book sitting outside in our yard watching the sun go down. And so I would go back and forth between the book and the sun going down. And I went, wow, that's a beauty emergency. And I actually called my wife to come outside and look at it, and we saved it. Talk about that. It's such a wonderful way to describe an experience that sometimes we miss if we don't pay attention, or make it an emergency, meaning let's go right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think we are so often thinking about emergencies as negative. period. If you think, oh, I got interrupted today because of an emergency, you would say, oh my gosh, oh no, what happened? And so you don't expect the person to say, it was the most beautiful sunrise, and I just had to stop what I was doing and yell for my kids and come gather at the back door and just stand there and look at it and watch it change. And so that's, I mean, again, it's about reframing, right? Like, there are things that are fleeting. Thankfully, a lot of the pain is fleeting too. It's temporary. We don't get to keep a white knuckled grip on any of this. We don't get to keep a white knuckled grip on the good, but on the bright side, we don't get to keep a white knuckled grip on the bad. That's going to go too. But really wanting to, I mean, I want to be here now. That's really the idea. And so, yes, I really do try to stop myself and pay attention to things as much as possible. I think poetry has trained me well for that, because part of my job to do what I do as a poet is paying close attention. And that sometimes means beauty emergencies are part of that. And then instilling that in my kids. So sometimes they'll come and say, Mom, you've got to come look at this right now. And I do, because if I say, wait, hold on, I've got to send this email, it might be gone. That praying mantis might not be where they left it when they came running in the house, or the sky might not be doing the same thing it was doing when they came in the house. And so just being present.
How true is that?
Hey, Maggie, you've got a passage here about a gap year that, you know, we talked about this earlier. 2020 feels like it's our national gap year. Could we get that passage from you, and then let's talk about it?
Yeah. Try to shift your thinking away from loss and toward growth. Consider this difficult time a gap year between your last life and what might happen next. Think of it as the first messy, brave, hard, exhilarating year of your new life. Keep moving.
So was there a moment when this all made sense to you? Was it a eureka moment, or was it sort of the way Aeschylus described, sort of grief drips from us day by day? When did you know everything was going to be okay?
Is it? It's only October. I don't know if it's all going to be okay. You know, I think I started feeling better after, you know, it maybe 9 to 12 months in. And it basically took daily practice of not only writing and pep talking myself, but doing all the other things that we do when we're in pain, which is going out with friends and taking long walks in the woods and, you know, buying and listening to lots and lots of records and reading a lot. I mean, all literature is self-help. Really, you know, books are what we turn to when we need to think about what is possible and how elastic a human life is, and sort of get into someone else's imagination. So it took a lot of time, but I tried to let myself off the hook in that very painful year for doing anything other than just taking care of myself and my kids. I really focused there. And here we are again. Collectively going through a really painful, strange, uncomfortable year. And I feel like I'm right back in that gap year headspace again, which is, you know what? We're homeschooling. Yeah, I'm working from home. We're cobbling it together. We're doing our best. Let's extend as much grace to one another as possible as we all move through this time, and let's think about it less as a time to accomplish a lot of things, although there are a few things we really do need to accomplish next month. I'm trying to really think about it as a time to take care of ourselves and one another, and everything else will shake out and sort of take care of itself. It doesn't need to be a year to accomplish a whole lot. I'm not worried about my kids' grades this year. I'm worried about their hearts and minds and their physical and mental health, and the rest of it will be here next year, and we can sort it out then.
You also get into the value of silence and solitude, and that seems particularly germane during this period, and sort of segues from what you were just saying. Was that new, an appreciation for silence and solitude? And by solitude, I don't mean, you know, going away and going down in the root cellar or whatever. Solitude meaning alone with yourself, or in your case, with your children. Talk about those things. Were those rediscoveries for you, or discoveries?
Definite rediscoveries. I have always enjoyed a lot of time by myself. I was, you know, a kid who would listen to music in my bedroom and read books and do puzzles. And if anyone ever needed to find me, Maggie's probably in her room. That was my mode. And that kind of went away when I had kids, because when you're at home, especially with small children who don't just disappear into their bedrooms to get away from you, they really want to be with you. They want to show you their Lego stuff. They want to build the blanket fort. They want you to bake with them. They need help with their homework when they're learning from home. And so it's been very hands-on to be a parent. And I do need a lot of headspace, particularly to write. And so one of the sort of hidden gifts from this loss was having joint custody, right? Which I miss them when I don't have them. But on the other hand, I have these pockets in the week and in the month where I'm myself and I'm not caring for others in that way. And I can, you know, listen to a record and read a book and take a walk and get into that mindset. 2020 has maybe been more alone time than I need. I miss hugging people. I miss destinations. I miss airplanes. But you know, we're making the best of it.
Maggie, we've got about 40 seconds left here, but we are coming to the end of this year, 2020. I'm wondering, what do you say to people who have lost so much in 2020, in this pandemic, in the fight for social justice and other things? What do you say to them?
I think I go back to the idea of possibility, which is that when something burns to the ground, we mourn what was there, but there is a space that has been created there. It doesn't take away from the loss, but it gives us a chance to reimagine what could go there and to have our say and to rethink some things. And so that's the headspace I'm trying to work through from my own loss and grief. And maybe that might be helpful to others too.
Maggie Smith, the book is Keep Moving. It's What the Soul Needs Right Now. People should check it out. Thank you so much for being with us. That is all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Storing the Public Square.